You're listening to the Adoption and Fostering Podcast from Misadventures of an Adoptive Dad.
Well, hello, Scott, and welcome to this, which is the 17th edition of the Adoption and Fostering Podcast. 17.
Oh, blimey, we'll soon be into treble figures.
Treble figures.
Good evening, Al. How are you?
I'm really well, yes. It's a little bit frazzled, but that's life, isn't it? And how are you?
I think it's time of year, isn't it? It's time of year. The weather's getting better. The nights are nice and light.
Oh, I know.
You spend more time doing things.
Yeah. I think it's a bit of a trick, isn't it? Because normally in the winter by this time, you'd be bedded in, ready for, like, 20 past nine. Mm-hmm. Bedded in, ready for sleep. And now I'm still out in the garden, pottering on.
Yeah.
That's probably why I'm tired.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, I've just left Mr. Husband oiling the deck. So, and it's 9 at night. So,
yeah, all right, excellent. Everyone needs a husband like that. I could do a husband like that. what is it, Mae West, who said, what I really
you
need
are
is
the
a
husband
good
like
wife.
That.
Oh, a useful husband who can do functional things. Can he sharpen axes?
No, I don't think that's in his remit.
Oh, that's him and me finished.
He can certainly sharpen claws. He can sharpen claws.
Oh, that's handy.
Very good at that. Bless his heart.
Anyway, we're way off point, aren't we?
Anyway, that's just today's issues.
So we talked a long time ago about sort of moving into taboos, because I think there's lots of things that we as adopters don't talk about, or if we do talk about, we're careful who we talk to them about, and there's issues that we don't that are kind of floating around. So with that in mind, I took the opportunity to speak to someone who might be able to kind of shed some light on some stuff. A guy called Mike Armiger, who I'd met a few times, and he kindly gave me a good 40 minutes on a taboo subject. So I guess there's a health warning with this, isn't there? You've listened to it already, haven't you?
I have. It's heavy listening.
Yeah.
Has to be said. It's heavy listening.
Yeah,
and I will be listening to it again as well, because I think that there's a lot of information in there.
Yeah,
it's
discussing sexual
abuse. It's a stark reminder, actually, isn't it?
Yeah,
yeah,
and that's a reality for a lot of the families that we know and I, you know.
It is
about sexual abuse. So there's a kind of a health warning if it is a sensitive subject, and some of the conversation is quite graphic, appropriately graphic. Mm. So if you turn off your radio now, really, stop listening if it's going to kind of give you wobbles, but please feel free. Any of the issues, press your buttons, get in touch, and we can point you towards appropriate support. So we'll put it on and then we'll have a chit-chat.
We shall.
Well, hello, Mike, and thank you very much for agreeing to speak to me on the podcast. Could you give me a really quick introduction as to who you are and how you ended up being who you are?
That's an in-depth question. I like that. It's a pleasure to be talking to you, Al, and I'm really grateful to be doing this for everybody. My name is Mike Armiger. I am a former birth child within the foster family. I am also a foster carer myself, although I don't currently have any children facing me right now. And I am a former teacher and somebody that does a lot of campaigning for a lot of children within the care system, and run quite a bit of training and consultancy services, as well as still teaching a couple of days a week as well. So my diary is particularly busy, but when I'm at my biggest passion and where my real interest is within looked after children, within their families and therapeutic support as well.
Well, that's quite a... There's a lot in there. I mean, we could unpick some of that stuff. So tell me about your... Because you offer training. You're a trainer, aren't you? That's one of the other things that you do. And one of the reasons I wanted to speak to you was around the caring for children who've been sexually abused. And I think that remains a taboo. And often, adopters get these hideous forms that say, would you accept the child who has a disability? Would you accept the child who has experienced neglect and trauma? And people go, yes, 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 yes. And then they get to the sexual abuse one. And a lot of people, it's a grey, murky area, and people tend to just say, actually, no, to become honest, which is a fair fair thing, but I think we don't know very much. So I want to talk to you. So tell me your experiences and kind of what that's led you into.
Sure. Well, I completely agree with those statements, by the way. I think for me, I've always lived with these children. We had many children come through the house. My mother worked for Women's Aid. My father was a teacher. And by complete chance, we ended up with a child who was in a refuge that my mother was working at the time. And we first started fostering him, and we had him for about 4 years. And then from there, we had children come to the house that had that particular complexity in terms of sexual abuse, although we weren't aware of that on our very first child that we had, and which will resonate with many people listening to this right now, I can imagine.
Yeah.
And so it blew everything wide open in terms of I was 13 at the time. And I actually heard some of the disclosures, not through my parents' willingness, and they tried very much to protect us as much as they could. But my sort of innocence at that age was thrown right out the window, and my perception of the world because of the information, and it was particularly graphic. I mean, it just so happens, yeah, even though I'm working in that field now, it's still probably one of the worst things I've ever heard, and I was at a young age. So that, from there, my family specialised in that in particular, and we went on to foster more and more children in that particular nature.
I mean, that's really interesting. I mean, that is everyone's nightmare situation, isn't it? That this stuff kind of is released into your family, not intentionally, not on purpose. There's no sense of malice or deceit. It's just sometimes we don't know. We don't know the full biography, and then it unravels. That must have been quite a shock for your parents.
It was when I look back at it now, I mean, hindsight is a wonderful thing.
Yeah.
And when you look back, you can look at how you were living. And it was really, if I'm being honest, we were in crisis completely for probably around 7 to 8 years.
Right.
What struck me was that actually the amount of vicarious trauma that professionals experienced throughout that process, because when this child disclosed, it was so graphic and so far beyond the realms of normality. And you have to think as well, this was over 13, 14 years ago. So we didn't have the huge cases that we do have now and the information we have. So this was an even more of a taboo subject than it is now. And so what happened was that we had many professionals who were meant to support us in terms of police officers, because it was obviously a criminal investigation. There were social workers, there were child psychologists. We had probably around 5 or 6 people go on leave and come off the case because of vicarious trauma. However,
yes,
at that time then, I'm seeing everybody come into the house and say, oh yeah, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. Not doing that because they don't really understand what they're dealing with, and it's on such a scale that they've never seen before. And then they go off, and then all of a sudden, I'm sort of looking around, seeing my mother and father coping with this. Well, not really coping with it, being honest. And I'm sort of thinking, well, hang on a minute, I'm 14, 15, I've got to go to school every day, knowing that at any time I could be coming home and there's police officers at the table, there's social workers, family liaison officers, and I've just got to pretend that this isn't happening. But even worse, How's that child feeling? Like, you know, we can talk about professionals and they're a vital part of the support process, but what message is that sending to the child, that somebody's coming in to support them through this very difficult and vulnerable stage of their life? They then go, through no fault of their own, may I add, you know, because it's traumatic, but then this child is expected to cope with the aftermath. And then also, I think, there's an element of guilt that goes with that, because they're aware of what's happening a lot of the time.
Yeah.
I have very honest and open discussions with these children about people coming onto the cases, and they see the reactions from adults when they've disclosed or when they're recollecting information. They're very intuitive beings,
yeah,
and they're used to having to pick up on levels of volatility within adult behaviours from the environments that they've been in, so they can see it coming a mile off.
They're highly attuned to the reactions of adults and the moods and the perceptions. But, I mean, the social work training is, you know, don't look shocked, but show an empathic response. But the reality is if a child is telling you shocking things, it's normal to be shocked. It's an appropriate reaction to a shocking thing, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what was, and going on to look after the children myself and work particularly with children one of the things that we risk with disclosures, I think, is we have to react in a way that tells the child that we can cope with this, because ultimately if we're seen to not cope, how does that child feel is often the theory that's bandied around, which I agree with to a certain extent. However, we also then risk normalizing it as well. So actually, within this element of behaviors within sexual abuse, what you have to do is you have to provide an alternative rhetoric. Because one of the things that goes through children's heads, and I thought about this for quite a long time, and I've worked with a lot of children, have these conversations. And one thing that they suffer with is that this thought that it's easier to believe that they provoked it rather than believe that it could possibly happen again with another adult. And so that thought and that self-talk is going round and round in some of these children's brains. And so that has a very real impact on relationships and how they navigate the world.
Wow. I mean, it's a huge subject. And I think it remains a taboo. Do you see that? You've obviously got your own personal experience that's then developed into a kind of a professional perspective and the ongoing work that you're doing. Do you see that we're addressing that taboo? Do you see does it remain the shock for foster carers, adopters, that it used to be?
I think it's a multifaceted question, but I think we've definitely A, made progress, and B, we're starting to put provisions in place. I'm often presented when I do training, I'm often presented with a view. Things have got dramatically worse and, this kind of thing never happened before. And my argument is, well, we know it happened because the information that's coming forward from the majority of investigations and that are in the public spotlight, but also more and more people that have experienced this kind of abuse are now coming forward. So we know that it did happen previously and it happens on a systematic and monumental scale. So for me, it's just about exposure. We are now more exposed to the conversation, which I think is a good thing. Do I think that we are effective in reacting to it and combating sexual abuse cases? No. I still think we've got such a long way to go. I've worked with police teams in various different capacities, sort of as an independent liaison, and I've seen huge progress in terms of how police now investigate sexual crime. I think we are so much better at doing that. Previously, it would still, when this particular case happened with my family, I remember having to speak to police and social workers, and they accused myself and my family of making this up. And there was actually various different things that happened without going into specifics of that case that sort of questioned me being able at the age of 14 to come up with this elaborate theory. I'd love to know how I could have possibly made it out. That was the first judgment and the first thing that people moved to. Now I see it's got better. One of the biggest concerns, and without getting political, one of the biggest concerns I have is that they do not have access to the very specific support in terms of sex and relationship education as well. Like I mentioned earlier, that alternative rhetoric for these children is really, really important to combat that harmful self-talk that they're having within their own traumatic experiences. And what happens is that how you perceive the world, if it's based on that traumatic experience, is so in-depth and so detailed. And what we also fail to recognise, I think, within our care for those children is actually, forget the act of sexual abuse itself, the layers of manipulation on top of that act are so beyond imagination and so entrenched and so in depth that it never ceases to amaze me when children come out with things. I'm never not moved by a child when they've disclosed. I've become used to that sort of reaction now, and I'm certainly attuned to that. However, there are still things that children say that adults have told them before they carried out this act or whilst they carried out this act that still absolutely horrify me. And it's that alongside the actual act itself that we have to really appreciate.
It feels like a really, I'll be totally frank with you that having this conversation feels difficult because again, we're talking about really difficult things, things that are just horrific beyond what we want to comprehend. You know, I don't even want to think about it. Yeah, but do you think that, I mean, what are the strategies for people who are discovering this about the children? Because my experience and knowledge of families is that often there's grey areas in children's lives and children are coming in. And like when you were a foster carer, a suspicion becomes a certainty, becomes actually this has happened. What do people do? What should people do? You know, what are people doing now?
I think, there's some of the best practice I've seen is where actually carers and parents have got a lot of support in terms of psychiatric support and in terms of therapeutic was the word I was looking for, sorry. So in terms of therapeutic support, what often happens is that the child will get some sort of therapeutic input eventually. I mean, obviously, sometimes there's criminal investigations that are taking place. And so that support can have to, that sometimes it has to be timely, so it can't always kick in at the right time. But what I see in terms of good practice is when that support is extended to the people that are caring for this child as well. Because, you know, that child discloses and then they have this trauma. And then all of a sudden, you know, they're age 9, for example, they then have to go into school at that age and be expected to be at the same developmental stages as all of the other children. Yeah. Be expected academically to succeed in that area as well. And then the parents have to just get on with everyday life after this disclosure has happened. And they've often got other children. So it's that acknowledgement that this is a major trauma and this is something that we need to address. And the best practice is whereby that therapeutic input has run with families. And police liaison officers, for example, family liaison officers are fantastic when there's a criminal investigation happening. However, when that hasn't taken place, or if there's no criminal investigation, often the support doesn't kick in for the carers. Right. And that's one thing I have a huge problem with, because they are the first port of call. If this child is disclosed to that particular person, often it's because they recognise something within that person that they seem able to trust. They recognise them as being safe. So why would you not spend time making sure that that relationship remains intact and that relationship remains healthy as a professional? So one of my areas of work is doing that. In terms of specific strategies that we can do, one of the things I think that is important is that I see many children experience this at, say, ages 7, 8, 9, and then you will see nothing until the ages of 13, 14, when they start to navigate relationships in the world. And then behaviours, in terms of perhaps sexually harmful behaviours, in terms of risk-taking behaviours, start to become prominent. And what often happens, and we know this, Al, you know, we talk about this all the time whenever we meet, is that systematic failure sometimes to presume that everything's okay, so we're not going to put anything in now, and then all of a sudden it's like bang, here we go, age 13, and everyone's looking around the table saying, well, where did this come from? So for me, it's important at an early stage, if you recognize that there has been significant sexual abuse, that there is support put in place over a long period of time,
and here the door is left open.
Absolutely, and the door is left open, because what will happen is you then got to re-refer 2 years later, get chucked on a waiting list for 6 months, and it's just not good enough. In terms of things you can do within your home, one of the things that I spend a lot of time talking about with carers is the need to make sure that their bedrooms and these children's bedrooms are a particularly safe space, and that conversations don't necessarily have to take place within that room. I would prefer, many children, would prefer, not all of them, to have those conversations elsewhere and their bedroom remains something else. I think it's really important when you go through those disclosures to try and think out, okay, what is the daily impact of this child's thought patterns?
Yeah.
Because if this behavior took, if this abuse took place in a certain logistical area, whether it be a bedroom, whether it be an outside space, those are things we have to be mindful of in terms of understanding of vulnerability they may feel. Another thing as well is there's often this question, I'm sure you've dealt with this as well, there's often this question where if where that child should be placed in terms of, right, okay, we found out that they were perhaps sexually abused by a male. So we don't have any reason to believe that a female was involved in this directly. So therefore, one of the first things that people will do is say, okay, we need to then place them with purely males if we can find a single female carer.
Yeah.
Well, that I agree with that thesis on many levels. However, what I would also argue is that does that carer have any positive male role models within her family that she can over a slow period of time introduce that child to? So that they have, again, that alternative rhetoric and that balance.
Yeah.
Because if they don't, and we just hide them away from males, at the age of, like we said, 13, 14 earlier, when they start exploring relationships, they've got no basis to work from. So that's an important element to think in as well.
I mean, it's an incredibly complex and, I guess, individualized, because often sexual abuse isn't in isolation. It's, you know, comes with the manipulation, mm-hmm. control, and potentially physical abuse and emotional abuse. They're all, you know, it's a horrible soup of very traumatic experiences.
Mm. I can honestly say, Al, that out of all the cases that I've been involved in, particularly sexually abused, I mean, with neglect, and it's equally horrible, but with neglect, there's common themes that run throughout it. Yeah. With sexual abuse, every single case is particularly detailed and different in different areas. And there are some things that I hear and some things that are disclosed to me that I would never piece with another case. It's quite different and quite individualized based on the adult that is the perpetrator and the abuser, but also based on the child as well.
Yeah, I mean, it just, there's so many veins that we could go down around this. One question I had was that I think often adopters are in a situation where they have an uncertain biography. So they don't know about their children, or there's gaps, or there's question marks. And perhaps because of the age of the children, there'll never be that moment of, can I tell you something? It's more just behaviours and a child's kind of internal working model, you know, a traumatic, you know, working out that trauma. I mean, do you kind of think that people should go looking and saying, look, can we find, was this sexual abuse? Can we kind of go through the history again? Or the other way, where you look at a series of behaviours and go, well, that is indicative of sexual abuse. I mean, what's the recommendation for adopters? Because I think that's something that adopters often they're caught in that uncertainty.
Sure. And this is particularly prominent, and without drawing gender stereotypes, this is particularly prominent in a lot of male sexual abuse cases that I've seen, where actually they very much struggle to disclose. Every child struggles, but particularly males at a certain age, especially if they're a teenager, because there is that, you know, without going too deep into it, there is that chemical reaction which takes place, which makes them then question their sexuality, which then makes them question a multiple range of things. So there is an added complication there. I, in terms of that question, one thing that I think we should think about is that there, you know, if behaviours in terms of sexually harmful behaviours, or particularly over familiar behaviours, are being witnessed, we can presume that there may have been abuse. But what we can also presume, which is a theme throughout the majority of cases, is that they may not necessarily have been abused, but they've been exposed to a graphic nature of sexual violence, in terms of them seeing other adults in the home be abused, or their peers or their siblings be abused. So they might even be exposed to porn, for example.
Yeah.
So what happens is that even though that child may not have necessarily partaken in that act, there are the majority of cases that I work in where they've certainly been exposed to that. And they've been exposed to multiple different things and many different abuse areas. And it's like we said, that layer of manipulation on top of it earlier, which is particularly prominent. You look at child sexual exploitation. We have a huge problem at the moment, and we're getting better. But particularly when I go in to speak to schools about CSE, one thing that comes up is we say, okay, well, these are the risk factors that we've got to look out for. And these are the risk-taking behaviours we must look at. But what we fail to recognise, I think, is actually how that is linked to how that young person perceives themselves, yes, and where that perception has come from. Because often the reason that they partake in risk-taking behaviours is because they're particularly vulnerable. Why are they particularly vulnerable? Often because they live with adults who have been emotionally abusive or exposed them, yeah, to particular behaviours that they then seek to act out upon. So it's actually starting at that place and then joining up the dots further up.
Yeah, it's more than just a behaviour that's come out of the blue. There's a context, and there's a perhaps a normalisation around how they perceive themselves and how sex is, what function sex is in a normal relationship versus the relationships that they've seen or are used to.
Absolutely.
Can I take you back to a little thing you said? You talked around young men and or boys who've been sexually abused. You talked about a chemical reaction and that making them question their sexuality. I've not heard that before, and I was just wanting...
No, sure. I think it's important that we do talk about it, because I think what happens with a lot of male victims and survivors of sexual abuse is that because they've had a lot of time, say, for instance, an erection, that then makes them question whether or not there is a factor, oh gosh, that, you know, their self-talk is almost like, right, did I ask for that experience?
Yes.
And this is the same with females, you know, but we're talking about a specific physical reaction here. Did I ask for that? Did I enjoy that in a certain way? So there is that destructive self-talk happening. And then you're not just questioning your own experience and your own perception of the world. You're then questioning your identity and, yeah, your sexuality. And so what happens is that, you know, you have two complex natures then. You have, whether on two complex situations, you have the situation where, do I disclose the sexual abuse because that's particularly shameful for myself and I've experienced this? Also, if I expose that, does that mean that I am gay? Does that mean that I have to jump to this label in terms of my, yeah, gender?
Am I culpable in some sort of way because I enjoyed it, therefore I must have invited it? Or
absolutely.
And then you can discuss the sexual abuse, but then you have to, in the midst of that, discuss the fact that you did have an erection. You,
absolutely,
you know, so, yeah.
And it is that. And one thing I say quite a lot, and it's very difficult for people to hear, but if you think about sexual abuse in this way, it often helps look at to identify the complexity of the situation, because you have children that have been chronically neglected.
Yeah.
And that is equally as horrific and does equally as much damage in terms of the brain and neurological impact. And what happens is that if you have a child that's been chronically neglected, it's a lack of connection that's a problem. Now, with a child that's been sexually abused, often neglect will go hand in hand. But although it's the most horrendous connection to have, they've had some form of connection. And the problem with it is that that connection obviously is completely destructive and completely abhorrent.
Yeah.
But they've had some form of connection, which means that you're not dealing with a lack of connection. You're dealing with them having a connection in completely the wrong areas and completely beyond.
A dysfunctional...
Absolutely. So actually, what you have to do is, when we said that alternative rhetoric earlier, you have to really push that forward. And what happens is that, you know, I talk a lot about sexually harmful behavior. And if you think about it, if that's the only way that you've been taught how to please adults and you've not had any alternative rhetoric,
yeah,
or any exposure to other healthy models of a relationship, that's how you behave and seek out attention. And I see many carers that are in a position whereby they get these children into their homes and, you know, they're not always necessarily made aware, or even if they are made aware, they're not ready,
yeah,
for the behaviours that they're going to see. And it's definitely not their fault. It's not the child's fault. But nobody stops and turns around and says, right, hang on a minute, this is likely to be what you're going to see.
Yeah.
Just know that actually this is a product of this. This is, yeah, not the child choosing to behave in this way.
It's not seductive or, you know, promiscuous. It's just a learned behaviour.
It is, yeah. And I think, and you've hit the nail on the head there, because my next phrase was going to be, I have a real problem with people describing that behaviour as promiscuous, because that involves and implies some element of intent.
Yes.
And these are children. And actually, like you said, it's a learned behaviour. In the same way that we teach children, you know, you have, you know, battles with parents, don't you, where,
yeah,
you know, your partner and you are trying to get them to say your name first, or,
yeah,
or, you know, you're holding the baby up and saying, mum, 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 dad, 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 or whatever. And so in the same way, that's how a child learns to navigate the world, and that's how they learn to speak. And, yeah. and that happens within multiple areas of child development. And this is exactly the same process that goes on in terms of how that child is informed to perceive relationships and seek them. And so they have that basis to work from. And unless you provide that alternative, and unless you counteract that rhetoric very, very early on, and almost quite graphically as well sometimes, I struggle with, I have to be sometimes very explicit in terms of the language, not swearing, but in terms of the language that I might yeah. use with a child in my care or that I'm working with, where and this would only be where I know very, very carefully and specifically the details of the case, where I've had to say to them, the reason you are doing this, or do you think the reason you're doing this is because of that experience you have?
Yeah.
And what happens is that unless you spend time matching those things up with the child, then they don't understand why they do things. So,
and I guess that then speaks to our cultural norm, which is you don't have those conversations with children. You don't talk mm-hmm. in those explicit, graphic terms to children. And it takes quite a strong constitution to do that. Especially, I mean, as a specialist, you may go in and that's your job, but as a parent, as a father, as a mother, a foster carer, foster mother, that is a real, that's a cultural barrier that is really hard to punch through.
It's one of the hardest conversations you ever have to have. And there's no doubt about it. And of course, you know, we have to put our professional hats on and say that there are people that have to advise on that type yeah. of conversation. And we have to make sure that we've done that in liaison with certain people. But what I would say on the back end of that is that actually, if you think about say a 13-year-old male who has experienced quite graphic sexual abuse, hasn't had those conversations, they then seek to explore relationships. And one of the big things that happens is that they engage sometimes in quite sexually harmful behaviours. Mm-hmm. And those sexually harmful behaviours are all based around around false expectations. So what happens is that, you know, for instance, I had a case a couple of years ago where a child of that age had decided that he'd taken quite a fancy to one of the girls, same age, the age of 13, and had accosted them outside the toilet area and had tried to pull their skirt down. Now, luckily, it was all stopped and it was intervening quite quickly. But it was all based around the false expectation, because when I yeah. then had the conversation with him, the false expectation was that she was going to enjoy it, that that's how boys behave towards girls,
yeah.
that that's how you showed somebody that you were interested in them, and that actually it was an act not of control, but it was an act of desire. And desire yeah. goes hand in hand with the behaviours and the thoughts that he was thinking. So when you unpick all of that, it makes sense to that person who's had traumatic experiences. So those false expectations have to be almost chipped away at over a long period of time, which is why I direct people back to the fact that I've always fought for children who've had these experiences, having very, very detailed and specialist sex and relationship education, whether it be in school or whether it be in the house, because that is vital.
And it's tailored to their specific experience or what we know of their experience.
Absolutely.
One question I was going to ask you, and it's, I am going to put the explicit warning on this podcast, so no one should wander onto it by accident thinking, you know, expecting yeah. stories about Orphan Annie and, you know, all of these lovely things, and then find this, they'll be traumatized.
Yeah, exactly. It's not a conversation you want to be listening to on loudspeaker in the kitchen whilst you're cooking your tea, is it?
No, that'll provoke all kinds of conversations over the chopped carrots. The question I was having about children who then go on to become perpetrators, and that's, I think that links into what you were saying about their understanding and potentially that they've been groomed to follow that behaviour through. And I had a friend who was a foster carer adopter, but they basically had had an interesting mix of a family where they had some teenage girls and a younger boy who's in his early teens. And the arrangement was that they loved him dearly, but they had came to an agreement where they said, actually, we're going to lock you in your room every night, which I say it like that because it provokes a response, but they locked him in with a piece of cotton. And they used saliva to put it across the door, and they said, You can come out if you need the toilet, but you need to come and tell us you've done that. You can come out if there's an emergency. You can give them a whole list of reasons why you could, it was appropriate and right for him to come out. But if you came out for other reasons, then we don't think you can live with us. And he totally accepted that. And it was a way of him moderating his own feelings. So I just wanted to know your experience of children who become termed as perpetrators, because actually already I think you've reframed how I think about the phrase.
It's really difficult because you have to take into equation and consideration that actually many carers who look after these children also have their own children. Mm-hmm. So one of the questions that I will often get asked when they're assessing for adoption or a long-term foster care is, okay, what is the risk to my own children? And I never shy away from that question because I think, you know, as I was very lucky growing up, but obviously I was the eldest. So actually there wasn't necessarily that much of a risk. But obviously my brother was younger than we had younger children in the house as well.
Yeah.
So my parents had to consider those needs and those vulnerabilities as well. And so I always am very explicit with those carers and with those adults and saying, look, there is a particular risk and you do have to be vigilant. There are things that you have to consider with particular cases. And again, without wanting to horrify people, you also have to think about animals and things like that as well.
Yeah.
There is multiple things that are incorporated within that abuse that make it so complex and things that you would never imagine. I remember one child, and this isn't necessarily linked to sexual abuse, but it just goes to prove that you can never always join up all the dots. We had a curry, and I remember one child having this curry, and she had a complete freak out and was under the table and was screaming. And afterwards, she explained that the sensation of spikes in her mouth was a similar feeling to where her mother used to put cigarettes out in her mouth, and that burning sensation. And, of course, you know, it's horrific. And you would never in a million years have been able to join that up. You wouldn't equate it.
At all, no.
No, exactly. So, I mean, we have to appreciate that as much as we, you know, I push people to sort of always ask the questions, there are always going to be things that we can't possibly imagine or cater for.
Yeah.
In terms of being quite open about children's behaviour, especially if it's perhaps sexually harmful, I think it depends very much on their age and also very much on whether or not they realise what's happened to them.
Yeah.
Because one of the big things is that moment of realisation with all looked after children or adopted children, of whatever abuse or lack of care they've experienced, they get to an age where they actually realise how it and what's happened, and B, how it has affected them in their lives
and what that means. Exactly,
and what that means going forward, and how their future looks. So I think it's very difficult, and I always think that those decisions have to be taken on a case-by-case basis. One thing I would say, though, is that structured play, especially with younger children, is really important, and I always advocate for carers to go on play training and to look at how they use play as a model. Because one thing that happens is that if you have a child, for instance, and I had this a couple of weeks ago, you have a child that has taken the brunt of the abuse for their siblings, what happens is that they have to exercise a certain element of control in many different areas in order to keep their siblings safe.
Yeah.
And what happens then is that when they maybe split up from those siblings and they may go off into different families, and they're then with other children, whether it be in school or within the home, they do exactly the same thing, and those behaviours transfer. And it's linked to the demand anxiety cycle in terms of where they place their anxiety, but it's also linked to a protective nature as well. So I think structured play with them is really, really important. The issue of going back to bedrooms again and going back to genders, you will normally find that there is a line to be drawn that children will often draw themselves in terms of who they go into. And if you have a typical heterosexual couple fostering or adopting, they will draw the line of, right, okay, I may venture towards females more than I would males in terms of who I'm going to seek that relationship with. And I always say to kids, look, don't be offended by that. That's just who they feel safe with at that particular time. And that may turn. But you do also, one of the most terribly difficult conversations to have is when children do present as over familiar And you know, people will use the word flirtatious, but I tend to use open familiar. I think that's a more friendlier term.
Yeah.
And you have to have those conversations with adults that come into your house, with your friends, with yeah. your with your family, and that's really horrendous to do. But there have been times of these, and you know, one thing I'll say about my mother in terms of that in that situation, she got absolutely spot on, was that she would not apologise for having that conversation, and she used to say to them, if you feel like when you're interacting with that child, first of all, yes, you need to be very careful, and here's what we do. Not yeah. scare them, just inform them of the basics and say, this is how we interact with them. This is the model we follow. But if they are inappropriate, you come and tell me, because there and then we need to have that conversation there, and we need to yeah. have that conversation with yourself as well. And she was really good at drawing those people into that conversation and actually turning it into a learning experience. And if we get carers and professionals into the habit of reteaching behaviours, then I think we're going to have a more productive conversation, a more productive future for those children.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much more I could chat to you about. I kind of am aware that we've been going on for nearly 40 minutes. I do have a few. Is there areas or places you can point people towards? What are good resources? What are, you know, good books, good websites? Where can people get help? What
I mean, one thing that, excuse me, one thing I point a lot of people towards is that there is the NSPCC do a lot of really, really good work for professionals and for carers around sexual abuse and sexually harmful behaviours. They have a lot of resources. They've commissioned their own research, and they're very, very useful for doing that. I would also say, if people aren't already, Twitter is a great place for foster carers. They have such a great community there, and I feel very honoured to be part of that community in many different ways. And people will, you know, message me with a question, or they'll say, "Look, I've got this difficulty. I'm not sure how to engage with services. I don't know this." And it just feels that there is that ability to share information. So if they're not on Twitter, I would suggest that they do. So they don't have to put their name; they can put whatever, and they can make up, you know, all the different names if they want. I used to have loads of. As a teenager, making up your email address, and so mine was, I think mine was Megabyte Mike. You know, I thought it was really cool.
Showing your age there, Megabyte Mike. with your Sega Mega Drive. But yeah, I mean, that's a safe place. But I mean, I'll put your Twitter handle on the podcast bio stuff. And I mean, I guess what about in the instance of people realizing that there's, you know, the children are starting to talk about stuff and starting to speak about experiences, other things. Where would you recommend, if it's a criminal act, do you go straight to the police, or do you go through a social worker? Or
I think it's very difficult. Again, if you believe that there's been criminal behaviour, then I would suggest, yes, that you speak to the police. However, there are also complexities with that. Because what often happens, I mean, if they're open to a social worker, I would certainly suggest that the social worker is the first port of call in many cases. However, if it's an adoptive placement, obviously, and they haven't got a social worker involved at the time, then I would suggest the police is the first port of call. However, it is also a difficult situation because there are, again, very complex things involved in that case. So actually, there have been cases where, many cases, sadly, where actually adults who have sexually abused these children have dressed up perhaps as police officers or have taken a role, again, feeding into that whole level of manipulation.
Right.
So it's just important to extend your imagination in that specific moment and think, okay, who is going to be a trusted person that I can engage with? Because for many children, calling the police in is going to be a complete freak out. Of course they have to be involved, but you're going to have to spend a lot of time building that relationship and doing it properly before you even get to a disclosure point with that profession. Yeah. So how you handle it is really important. If you do have any questions, though, then the first thing that I would recommend people do is to ring local children's services and the local safeguard and children's board so you can discuss that with them. And they can often give you great advice and say, okay, this is what I would recommend you do, this is what we're going to do, and go forward from there. But one of my biggest tips for any adult who has taken a disclosure is to yes, we talk about not presenting a shock, then to be very matter-of-fact about that and to try and show that you're coping, that's fine. But also I would recommend, if you do feel that you're completely traumatised by that you build a base around you of people that have experienced perhaps similar things themselves or have experienced a very similar thing, because it can be a very isolating place. And that network of other carers who have gone through similar things is so important. And it's something I wished that, that my family had when we experienced it. So go forward and make sure that you seek those relationships out.
Well, that's great. And I think it is such a sensitive issue. If you can find some friendly social workers and those you've got historic relationships with, or I guess even returning to the social work teams that you knew if you were an adopter, that
sure.
that they may already have some of that history and they may be able to kind of sensitively, they're not starting at day one, they may be already down the journey. Mm-hmm. That's fantastic. Thank you. I really appreciate your time. And I know there's loads of other things I'd like to talk to you about. I think I've had conversations with you about schools, supporting children in schools, which is you are passionate about, because I know you were a head teacher, weren't you?
Yes, for my sins. And I came out of the profession, not completely, but in terms of wanting and need to go and train and to do various different things on a strategic level, because I found that as much as I was making an impact in those children's lives, that there was a bigger cause to be fought for. So you will see me ranting quite a lot on social media, probably every day, about systematic failure. But it's something that I will sadly never accept. And I'm tenacious in making sure that we don't accept it for our kids either.
Well, would you come back to the podcast and talk about that systematic failure?
How many episodes do you want?
We'll break it up into maybe a 40 or 50 part, hour long piece.
A mini series.
Yeah, we'll do a mini series. Oh, Mike, thank you very much for talking to me, and I hope you have a great week and you're not so busy, because I know you're running around up and down the country, across countries, aeroplanes, trains, planes, automobiles, and walking, no doubt.
Definitely. Thank you. I'll take care.
Yeah, look after yourself.
Thanks, mate. Bye.
Bye bye. Okay, so that was a conversation with Mike, which was really interesting and very frank. What kind of stuff jumped off the page for you when we were listening to all that?
Do you know what? I think that my thoughts on this aren't specifically about anything they talked about. I think it's more about the topic. It's a little bit like the CPV thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's there. We know it's there, but let's just kind of ignore it in some ways. And I know that, you know, I mean, I've seen it on lots of social media and support sites and stuff. So, you know, people are living this day in, day out with the children who've gone through this. And it's akin to some of the kind of diagnoses that, you know, for FASD and all those kind of range of sort of things where it's with them all the time. They maybe don't exhibit the effects of it all the time, but it's definitely there. It's definitely being lived. And I think for me, it's the part about a child making sense of all that, because they've got so many other things to make sense of, like, you know, where they come from, why they're here, and, you know, to add all that into it. I mean, oh my days.
And I think Mike did sort of touch on that around how you change those narratives. About even just, there was a bit where he was talking about those kind of really graphic conversations to help children make sense of what's happened to them. And you kind of go, oh, I didn't sign up for this. I didn't, you know.
I know. Yeah. And I think that, you know, is I can't recall from the conversation, but is that something that people can gain support for? I very much doubt it, in terms of being able to tell the story, you know. It's just unfathomable, actually, how people can cope with that, whether they're the parent or the child.
Yeah, and when you look at the statistics in the general population, it's something like 1 in 20 children experience sexual abuse at some point. Mm. And I would imagine within the cohort of fostering and adopting, it's much higher. So there must be a lot of families who are really dealing with this on a day-by-day basis, whether knowingly or unknowingly.
Yeah. And that's the other thing, you know, the unknowing ones as well, you know?
Yeah.
It just blows my head, actually, that it blows my head that people could do that to children, but equally it blows my head of having to deal with it, you know, the after effects of all that. And, you know, that is with them for life, isn't it?
Yeah. And I think there was another thing he said about the ongoing support. And it comes back to that we cannot actually, the children that we care for, we are not islands. We can't live in this little 2.4 kids and a Volvo and a retriever, can we? We need families, we need friends, we need peers to support us, and we need professionals, you know, ongoing relationships, which I think is a theme that's come back. Every podcast is this sense of partnership with professionals, which is so elusive, isn't it? You know, within your own family. I know within us that, again, we lost another professional, and you go, oh. So we have to start again, and we have to make those relationships tell the stories again, and it's heartbreaking. We're not doing very good on
this one.
We're not doing good on the banter, are we?
No. Well, I think it's respectfully so. In all honesty, it's a lot of food for thought, and I think that, you know, I'm. And however this sounds, it's meant to sound respectful to those that go through it, but I feel blessed, actually. We don't have issues around that within our family, because I'm not sure how I would be able to cope with that. I really am not. But then, you know, you say that about a lot of things. I guess it's one of those things you live with, isn't it, day in, day out. But I've got huge respect for the children that, you know, come out the other end with this, and their parents for being able to support them through it.
Yeah. I mean, it's a hugely sensitive issue, and I've mentioned it in the conversation, but I think that often we're in a situation with all of our children that actually there's so much uncertainty that for many families, they didn't sign up for this, and perhaps they wouldn't have opted for this, but it's a credit to them that they... Mm-hmm. They keep going, you know, what's their options, of course, but
yeah,
a lot of food for thought. Now I'm going to try and move us on to something less serious. Can I move us on? Yeah. Will that work? Because we're both quite doer now, aren't we?
I mean, respectfully so, I think, but you know, it's
appropriately so.
It's perhaps something that, you know, might come up again in the future.
Yeah, Mike also is very good. He's working with schools. He said there that he worked, I think he was the headmaster of a children with special educational needs school. And he's got some really good insights into supporting children in school. And he's just, you know, when you meet people, there's professionals who speak common sense. And it's kind of common sense that he can back up with lived experience, science. So it would be really nice to get Mike back on and sort of fish his brains and get some more stuff. I do know one thing. I believe that the Adoption UK conference has been...
You know, I do not like...
I'll cut that out then. Things
like this, but I will. Because, only because it has taken up the last 4 weeks of my working life to bring it all together. It was one of Hugh's parting legacies, shall we say. How do you fancy doing the conference this year?
Has he walked out the door on his last day?
I need to learn how to say... Yeah, he's running out the door. By the way, and rather than say no, I said yes. Now I do have I've got a lot of support actually from colleagues who are helping to organize it. So I can't take all the credit, but I am kind of leading on the organization of it this year. And we decided to do it around education, trauma and attachment in the classroom. We've got some really good speakers. So we've got Jane Pickthall, who's your virtual school head, I believe.
Whee!
Yeah, but she's also the chair. Yeah, she's also the chair of the National Association of Virtual School Heads. We've got Her Royal Highness Daniela Shanley from Beech Lodge, who is proprietor of Beech Lodge and the development director of Tagus, the school's.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I think it's off the top of my head, it's social and emotional development thing.
That's a cracking lineup.
Thing at the end of it.
You've got like an all-star lineup.
who's, we do, well, actually, there's more speakers to be announced. And when we're talking about stars, I'm not saying any more at this precise moment in time, but there are some other names that you will recognize.
That's exciting.
And who are going to be there as well.
Oh, right.
So it's on November the 11th. So the next few months, I'm going to be having nightmares, sleepless nights. I already have, actually, and myself and Jack, who've been organizing it at work, we've both been dreaming about each other.
Just tell more.
Not in a positive way, that's to be said.
There is a positive way?
Well, I would hope there would be. But it's been really exciting to do, and I'm honoured to be organising it. But we have thrown the whole rule book of organising the conference out of the window, and we're really kind of just trying to do it in a way that makes it accessible to more people. So fingers crossed.
That's commendable. I mean, the last Adoption UK conference I went to was in 2008, I think. And I can't remember it because it was the height of the dark times. And we just went away and we had a nice time. And that sounds really good. I might consider coming. I'm doing something I should tell you about as well. Oh, we're doing something. How could we forget?
We're doing more than one thing. What are you on about? Honestly, I feel like I've been kidnapped and I'm being dragged around the country by
you. You feel like you're my seventh child. The naughty one. So on the 12th of July, we're going to Islington Town Hall, aren't we? And we're going to do the Scott and Al Roadshow. A bit like the Radio 1 Roadshow. We're going to be down in Hip for the Kids. And we're going to do a CPV.
Yeah. Well, more like the Markham and Wise Roadshow, really, isn't it?
Yeah. 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 Please don't come to Mac. And so we're going to talk about child-on-parent violence, and I'm going to be delivering some stuff, and you're going to be doing some stuff, and it's going to be a really interesting night, and we're going to make it fun, aren't we? We're going to have some fun, because I can't bear these boring conferences.
No, it's rubbish when they're too... it's a serious subject, isn't it?
Yeah, but we can laugh, and we can cry,
Exactly, we're still alive.
Cry. So that where people get into touch
and
that,
I think... I'm...
Spit it out.
No, I was just going to say, I'm really interested to see what the night's going to feel like with us being stood next to each other for a change, having banter. I think that's going to be really interesting. So anybody who's coming, don't expect too much.
It's like a sociological experiment, isn't it? That's one thing we're doing. But as well, do you know... The puppet master, Dr. Wendy Thorley, she's organised an event in the northeast of England on the 8th of June, a free open-air event in the University of Sunderland on the impact of trauma and loss and child and parent violence. And she said, just invite as many as you can. So we've reached about 250 because it's free, and we're starting to freak out now because we're probably going to have to find a bigger venue or something. But so that's a free event. And if you look on the Children Who Experience Loss and Trauma website, or you look through my timelines, you'll find that. You'll find all the information through our timelines, won't you? And we'll maybe put a link somewhere. We'll keep putting links out. And what did we do last Sunday? Come on. What day is it today?
Who?
We set up our own email. No.
Yes. Our adoption posturing Twitter feeds.
I love it.
That's been quite an eye-opener, actually. I like it.
Why have you been...
Although you do tweet more than I do.
But... I do. But I love it because we can be rude to each other.
You keep offering me for washing windows. Stop doing that. You keep on offering my services to wash people's windows. When I am not washing
We've clearly ascertained that in your marriage, Tris does all the useful stuff, so I'm offering the wrong Cass and Rennie.
You are, really. Yeah,
excellent. And I can come round and chop your trees down.
But I'm really, well, exactly. If we had any trees, you'd be more than welcome. In fact, where were you when I had to get rid of my tree stump to put my new decking down? You weren't there, were you? I'm glad you kind of brought that all together. So well done, you. I think that it helps us to kind of maintain that little bit of a kind of, you know, I don't want to be boring everybody by the podcast every 5 minutes. So it's nice that we've now got our own Twitter feed to be able to do that. They can be bored from that instead.
Well, I think my idea is that if people want to engage with the Twitter, if people are not bothered by the podcast, that's fine. They're clearly wrong, but that's fine. And but those who are interested can follow us on Twitter.
Yes. The number one most listened to podcast, adoption and fostering podcast in the UK. I mean,
is that true? Are you nodding your head?
It is true, yeah.
It is true. I think we're world famous on Twitter.
It is.
Right. Okay, I think we should go because we've meandered into prattle.
Yes, and, we've bored each other now.
Yeah. Okay, well, you have a friend.
We have. But just to say, the other event before you go,
yes,
it's 5th of July, University of Salford.
We're doing
that as well.
Yeah.
Do not forget.
We should organise that, shouldn't we?
And that's CPV as well.
Yeah. I think we should get matching T-shirts or something.
I think we should, actually. And I'm going to be meeting the great Mrs. C the night before as well.
Well, bring your drinking wellies.
I'm not sure if drinking wellies or hangover wellies I need. One or the other.
Both.
I'm looking forward to doing that as well.
Bless her heart. Oh, that'll be champion. So we're out and about. We've got a busy few months coming up. And you're away on holiday, so have a fantastic holiday, you and your beloved. And I shall no doubt speak to you soon.
Yes, take care. Have fun. Tatty bye.
Hip, hip.